This is the Sonny Morea interview for April 10th, 2007. Thing, as I said, I've already got your story, how you came to Huntsville. That's fascinating. But I'd like you to speak a little bit about your first meeting with Dr. Von Braun, because I think that's significant. You had never heard of him before, is that right?
I had heard the name, but I was not sure who the man was.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started to inquire, I found out that, well, he was a fellow in Germany who headed up the V2 program.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of awesome right there. But when I came down here, being in the military, I was assigned to General Topjoy's staff immediately. And the first thing I did was pay a visit to General Topjoy, along with four other second lieutenants.
Okay.
What General Topjoy told us was that he had assigned us all, since we had technical backgrounds, to Werner von Braun, who was heading up the Guided Missile Development Division for the Army at that time. And he said, you know, he felt like we would be able to contribute to some of that area.
Were you there by yourself, or did others come in with you during that initial meeting? Yeah.
As I recall, there were a couple of others that were there with me.
Okay.
That came in. I think he sort of had an afternoon social.
Okay.
At his home. And that's when he told me, you know, that I was to go see Dr. Werner von Braun on Monday morning, type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I showed up at Dr. von Braun's office, and I was invited to go into his office. He was not there at the time, as I remember, but came in very shortly thereafter. But there was his nameplate right on his desk, so I knew how to spell his name now.
Okay. Yeah.
And he came in, and he was very, very friendly and very outgoing individual, very easy to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that had impressed me the most was that he said, look, he said, I would like for you to, being that you have a mechanical engineering degree, I'd like for you to go into the different laboratories, see what they do, talk to the chiefs of those areas, see what they do, and try to come up with where you think you might fit best and where you might be able to make a contribution, and I will assign you there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was as simple as that. And I said, well, you know, how much time do I have to do this? Just take whatever time you need, but like 6 weeks is fine.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a tour of several laboratories and did exactly what he said.
What was your rank at the time?
I was a second lieutenant.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Second lieutenant.
Okay.
I had just come out of Aberdeen Proving Ground,
mm-hmm.
up in Maryland. And I selected the area of heat transfer and thermodynamics. I don't know why, but that just seemed to intrigue me. It was close to propulsion. I kind of was intrigued with that.
Okay.
And I was assigned to one of his paperclip Germans that came over from the V2 project. His name was Hans Paul.
I've heard that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I was assigned to Hans Paul. So that's sort of how I got into it. Now, how I got into management was kind of quirky, because we were sitting in a bullpen type of environment in the building that I worked in. And
because you transitioned into propulsion there, didn't you?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I was getting to.
Okay.
Actually, I transitioned into guidance and control from that job. But what happened was Von Braun had two deputies. One was technical, and that was Eberhard Reese,
mm-hmm.
who subsequently became center director.
Right.
Von Braun left.
Yeah.
And the other was a fellow who was dealing with outside contracts. His name was Ludwig Roth, R-O-T-H.
Okay.
Ludwig had a good master of the English language. He was a very suave sort of individual, very sharp. And he'd come in every morning and he'd walk right past this bullpen where he saw second lieutenants doing paperwork here or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he approached me after just 6 or 7 weeks that I was with Hans Paul. And he said, you know, he said, we're working the Redstone guidance and control problems right now for the Army, and we have some problems. We have a problem with a company up in New York called Ford Instrument Company, subsequently bought out by Sperry, I believe.
Okay.
And he said, I heard you're from New York, and I would imagine that you'd like to be able to make some trips up there if you could on government business. And I'd like for you to consider coming on board and being our liaison officer with us, with that company, to do the technical interface with that company, guidance of petroleum. Ford Instrument Company at that time made the servo mechanism to control the jet veins.
Ah, yes.
You know? And they were having some difficulties in that area.
Oh, the Germans used a similar thrust control on the V2.
Right.
But they preferred to call it the A4 for some reason, didn't they?
Yes.
Okay.
The V2, I think, was our nomenclature. The
Sometimes they're interchangeable, but
The A4 was, there was an A2 and an A3 and an A4.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked me if I would like to consider doing something like that. I said, sure. I figured 2 years in the Army, I just didn't spend it on the road going back to New York to see my family. Mm-hmm. My wife's family was there.
Now, was your first child born yet?
First child had been born in California, yes.
Okay. When you went up to New York, did you take your family with you, or did they stay here?
No, they stayed here.
I see, okay. That's just for my clarification.
Right.
Okay.
So we spent a year in California before we went into service.
Yes.
And then service assigned to
you. You were at North American Aviation, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I imagine that was of interest to Dr. Von Braun and Toftoy when they saw your Navajo work, I assume.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. They knew I had some experience in that area.
Okay.
Although it had been limited. I was doing the wind tunnel design for the Navajo program. I did the whole aft body design.
Okay.
Including where to put the pressure taps and sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We had something like 140 little pressure taps that went onto the wing of this little model.
Okay.
So that was technology that was overwhelming to me because the drill had to be a thousandth of an inch in diameter. The holes were that tiny, but they would make them essentially with the diameter of a hair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had 140 of these preparations in the wing to take pressure measurements on the wing.
I see.
It was very, very interesting how they would do it.
Okay.
So that's the background I brought to it. As I say, I got into the guidance control business. Well, my plan had been go back to North American Aviation as soon as I finished my military commitment. Well, at the end of my 2 years here, a little less than 2 years at that point, I guess Von Braun offered me a job to stay on in the technical liaison office, as it was called at the time. And I said, well, what I'd like to do is if I did stay on, I'd like to get back into propulsion. And he said, well, we can do that. And he was very accommodating.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on where he felt you wanted to make a contribution, he helped you get to that point where you could make a contribution and you took ownership of it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't just say, I want you to go work in this area, you know. And he said, I don't want to work in that area, you know. You wouldn't make much of a contribution with that sort of environment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I loved about Von Braun so much. He believed in participative management more than before the term was even invented in this country.
Yes, his management style, I think, was
his
really
management
unique.
Style was so unique.
And very appealing to people.
Extremely appealing. And in fact, that's why all those Germans came with him, and they died for that man. They really would, because he took care of them, and he gave them what they needed, and where they wanted to go, and he helped foster that whole type of environment. Unlike many American managers who were much more of the old school of carrot and stick. You know,
right.
It wasn't the case with Von Braun.
Okay.
So Ludwig Roth got me into the technical liaison office in the area of guidance and control. So it was just a matter now of shifting over to an area of propulsion. And that area happened to be run in that office by Conrad Dannenberg.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Conrad just said, come on over. And the first job he gave me, as I recall, was the Jupiter engine to get up to speed on the technical specifications of the Jupiter engine, which Rocketdyne was developing at the time, and was called the S3D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I worked S3D for a little while, and then all the studies began about the S1 and with the S1 vehicle, Saturn 1 vehicle.
Oh, yes, right.
And how many engines it would require, what kind of engines it would be.
Now you had completed your military service, and you were now civilian.
Yes. Exactly. I just become civilian when I transferred into propulsion.
Okay, and roughly what year was that? Can you remember?
Yes. '59.
Okay. We'll double check that, but I just want to have a general idea, because, okay.
The reason I'm hesitating is that a lot of things happened in that very short year, because within a year I was running the F1 engine program, okay? And I went H1, or S3D to the H1.
Yes.
And then that was strictly a technical project engineer type of position.
And you were reporting to Connie Dannenberg at the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right. And Connie Dannenberg, I forget who he was reporting to. I don't recall right now. But anyhow, I was reporting to Connie Dannenberg at the time. Then I think Connie left, and the process of evolution of coming up with a Saturn vehicle system of maybe 8 H1 engines came into being, and I was asked at that time to pick up the project engineering responsibilities for the H1 engine.
Okay.
I was not project manager, I was the project engineering responsibilities.
Okay.
I was responsible strictly for the technical side only.
The H1 was really, it really wasn't a modified Jupiter engine. It was really more involved with the design of making it, boosting up the thrust and that sort of thing. Yes.
Well, it was actually evolved from the S3D engine.
Mm-hmm.
But it took the negative parts of the design of the S3D and took care of it with some elegant solutions to it.
Okay.
For instance, one of the things we did is on the S3D, the package for turbo machinery was fixed in position as part of the base of the vehicle, and you ran the output of the turbo machinery, the oxidizer fluids and the fuel fluids, you ran them through pipes that articulated, because the engine had to articulate.
Yes, okay.
Okay. So you had these high pressure lines being articulated, and someone said, you know, one of these days one of those lines is going to let go.
Mm-hmm.
So why can't we put and mount the turbo machinery right on the thrust chamber itself and let it gimbal with everything, but at least the high pressure lines are fixed on relative to the thrust chamber. They won't be moving.
And was that in terms of rocket propulsion, was that a precedent?
Was that
a first?
Oh, yes.
I thought
that was
so.
A precedent.
Yeah.
So that was the biggie with the H1 engine. There were some other features that I remember that were different, but basically it was piggybacking the turbo machinery onto the thrust chamber itself, so that the high pressure lines were fixed and they were not gimbaled.
Okay.
The whole machinery was gimbaled with the thrust chamber. Now, we still had the problem then of the low pressure lines having to gimbal, because they were attached to the fixed structure of the tank. And so you had these big lines that were...
Right. The high pressure was the output from
the
turbo pump.
The output of the turbo pump,
was several thousand
PSI.
So, how was the fuel fed to the turbo pumps? Was it drawn by the turbo? Was it pressure fed? I'm not sure.
It was tank head fed.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever pressure you got from this long line.
Basically gravity fed?
Gravity fed.
Yes, okay.
To start with, that's right.
Okay.
But you still had to articulate those lines, and that was a problem in itself as well. And it resulted in some things that became known as POGO oscillations. You had some of these lower frequency oscillations.
Yeah, I don't
know. Because these big lines were operating and were busy.
So POGO seemed to be a problem that occurred even then. When people read about the Apollo program, immediately they think of Saturn V, but this was also something...
POGO went right back to the S3D days.
Okay.
Back to the Jupiter days, we had POGO.
And it was a function of a result of the fuel situation and how it was managed, I guess, in the system.
How it was brought into the thrust chamber.
Yeah.
And it picked up certain oscillations, and if they were in tune with some of the hardware, you'd start getting this this jumping effect.
Okay.
Fluid. And we called it pogo because it was like a pogo stick, you know.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay, so your work as an H1 engineer was what, a year, 2 years?
It was probably less than that. Mm-hmm. It was probably no more than a year.
Okay.
In fact, there was even a little bit of time in there where I worked the RL-10. I helped negotiate the specifications with Dick Mulready and Pat Whitney on the RL-10 engine, what it should look like as an upper stage engine.
Right.
Okay. So there was a little time that I was even working that. But it was during this period where I was working H1, S3D for a little while, H1, RL-10, when the F1 was being...
That was 58. NASA got the contract for that in, or awarded that in 58, is that right?
I believe so.
I guess the program came to NASA in 58.
No, it came to Marshall in November of 1960.
Oh, okay.
And that's when I was named the project manager for it.
Okay.
By that time, the technical liaison office was renamed as the Propulsion Program Office.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when Leland Ballou became head of that. And he had a number of project managers under him, one of which was the F1 project manager, myself. Another was the J2 project manager, which was Bud Drummond.
Mm-hmm.
And the RL-10 was in there.
Okay.
Forget.
There was an engine program office that
there
was sort
an
of an umbrella.
Program office, yeah. Umbrella.
And what building was this engine office located in? Because I spoke with Bill Sneed and a couple of others. There was the main building, and then two of the somewhat smaller buildings behind it. And you were in one of those two buildings.
Okay. So
okay.
86. It was 86 or one of those. So three.
Mm-hmm.
I think all three was where we were.
Okay. So you really didn't manage the work on H1 and F1 concurrently. You just sort of transitioned from H1 to the F1 program.
Exactly.
How did your promotion to the F1 manager position come about? Did Von Braun call you in? Did you speak with some others who, how did that all come about, I'm curious?
I think Von Braun asked for recommendations from the overall program office director, and that would have been Leland Ballou.
Mm-hmm.
And Leland looked at his staff and determined who he felt were competent people to run certain parts of the program. And he named me back to Von Braun. It was his recommendation to head up the F1, but Drummond the J2, the H1 to be managed by Jack Seymour, I think his name was.
Mm-hmm.
And the RL-10 was another, and I can't remember his name right now.
Because the RL-10 was going to be an upper stage clustered
mm-hmm.
engine for the Saturn
right.
1, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
There even
was a little C-1 engine that got involved in that. That was a reaction control.
Yes. Okay.
Type of thing.
The RL-10 didn't have, it didn't have a long life. It was sort of superseded by the...
J2.
Yes.
J2 provided the higher I-specific, which is a function of efficiency,
mm-hmm.
efficient use of the propellant, and it had a higher thrust level, both of which were in demand at that time for a Saturn V vehicle.
Okay.
But for the Saturn I vehicle, as I remember, they got by with an RL-10 for those missions, whatever they were.
Mm-hmm.
Don't remember them anymore.
Okay. Let me double check something here. Okay, we're doing fine. The transition from an Air Force F1 program handed over to NASA and Marshall program, I'm really trying to dig up as much information as I can on how much work was really done between Rocketdyne and the Air Force on the F1. Which I'm in the process of doing now, but when NASA acquired the program, Marshall acquired the program, what stage of development, hardware development, was this engine really in at that time?
It was in the earliest phases of hardware development. The Air Force was interested in something as large as an F1 engine. However, they never really
contracted for the fuller 1.5 million pound thrust engine. They did it in evolutionary steps,
mm-hmm.
and they were working on an E1 at the time.
Yes.
I think that was only 400,000 pound thrust engine. And NASA, on the other hand, felt the need for a larger engine than that. And initially, the involvement of NASA was out of Del Tischler's office in Washington, the headquarters itself. They had a couple of fellows up there that worried about engines.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to all the Air Force meetings about this engine. They influenced the specs and this sort of thing. And there was a gentleman called Oscar Bestio, who I think subsequently died, and Del Tischler.
Mm-hmm.
Del Tischler.
I've come across his name, yes. I've written some papers he's read, mm-hmm. some papers he's read.
These fellows were the ones who were kind of running the F-1 program, or the initial phases of the F-1 program. And Marshall was being asked to provide them with some technical support, and a number of people would go to those meetings with him, and I included one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that, the next step involved that, well, you know, if this is really going to be a piece of hardware that flies on a Saturn vehicle, we need to have managers out of Marshall Space Flight Center deal with it, and not having headquarters be responsible for it.
Okay.
So it was in at the time that, as soon as Marshall became an entity of NASA, which I think was in July of 1960.
Yes, that's right.
Immediately they began the process of how do we transfer the responsibility for the management of the F-1 to Marshall, because they're going to have to set up the detailed specs for this engine to make sure it mates properly with the stage and that sort of thing.
Oh, I get the sequence now. NASA got the F-1 program in 58. However,
right.
Marshall acquired the program in 1960,
exactly.
when it became a NASA center.
Right.
Okay. Now, initially, and you probably know this and can elaborate, the Saturn I was, I've read, was conceived to have four of these E1 engines initially, isn't that right? Or they'd given it some thought, or was it proposed?
You know,
I've read that
remember,
somewhere.
Yeah, you might
because
be right.
It's close to 1.5 million total.
You might be right, but I don't really remember that there was a very serious study
mm.
conducted about doing
yeah.
that, because the E1 hadn't been developed either.
No, I call it the elusive E1
exactly.
because, and I've seen pictures of it actually, they've actually done run tests on the engine, but of course it never went to production.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They were far away from production, and by that point, the Air Force had no interest in it anymore for some reason.
Mm-hmm. And that was RP-1 and oxygen.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So what were you, the F-1 engine, the scale of the thing, did it surprise you at first?
Well, you know, it was 10 times bigger thrust-wise than anything we had any experience with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 150,000 pounds of thrust was what we had some experience with out of the H-1 engine.
So it was an order of magnitude.
It was an order of magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
And with an order of magnitude change in the propulsion area came an order of magnitude difficulty in many problems, including the biggie, being combustion instability with that particular propellant combination.
Mm-hmm. This is what I'm very interested in learning. How did the relationship between Marshall and Rocketdyne on this engine program then? They transitioned from Air Force to Marshall. How did that get established? And did they have liaison engineers? I assume they did liaison engineers or managers.
Yeah, what I had asked for was that I wanted to have a representative of my office on site at Rocketdyne at all times during the development of the F-1. And that gentleman was Frank Bufola. You may have seen his name.
Okay. Yes, yes.
He was my man at Rocketdyne.
Okay.
Responsible for the...
Canoga Park.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And Rocketdyne had an office here at Marshall, actually not on the military installation, but they were here in Huntsville, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a number of programs, I guess, with Marshall. And so they did have a man who kind of worried about the F-1 engine program for to be an interface. If there was a set of interface drawings that needed to get to the West Coast quickly, why his father
would
pick him up.
Yeah, I would have thought Rocket Town would have had its an office of people here, not a lot, but
they did have an office.
Mm-hmm.
But within the office, they didn't have many people. They had like one man for the F1.
Yes.
One man for the S2 stage, which they were responsible. It wasn't Rocket Town, it was North America.
Yes.
They had a man in that office. I would say they probably had about 4 or 5 people there. That was about it.
Okay, that's
small
helpful.
Office.
Yes, okay. So, what, when the program then, what was laid out before you, and what were you having to tackle? I mean, when you look at the program and what was, at that point, it was established that the F1 was going to be, the Saturn C5 or the Saturn 5 in 1960 and 61 really wasn't locked out. The F1 and the Saturn 5 or C5 really weren't hooked up yet, because
right.
They were also looking at Nova as a possible vehicle for the engine.
Clustering 16 F1 engines on Nova.
and the diameter was like 50 some feet. I mean, not just 33 feet. It was really a gigantic launch vehicle. So the program was really very fluid at this point in terms of...
The first phase of the program was very fluid. We weren't even sure what the thrust level was going to be,
mm-hmm.
other than around about 1.5 million something.
How did you work out with the other laboratories at Marshall the facilities necessary to properly develop and test this engine?
The ones that we had here at Council?
Marshall, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, the representatives from the test laboratory, for instance,
mm-hmm.
were always in all of my meetings with the contractor. So they were up to speed as to what the requirements were for a test stand, what it had to do, how much, what the flow rates had to be to support it. If it was a traditional test stand that had a flame bucket to deflect the flame, what kind of water requirement was there for cooling the deflector. So they got very involved in the contractor's own design of the test stands and what they were doing, and they reflected that into the designs of what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
Now the requirement here was they wanted the capability to test at least one engine, singleton at a time. If you have some sort of difficulty and they just wanted to test the engine alone, they wanted that capability, so they built a single position F1 test stand. They also needed the capability to test the entire cluster of the engines.
Yes.
Okay. And so they built the test stand.
The S1C test stand.
And all of that was done by the laboratory here at Marshall, headed by Carl Heinberg, if I remember the name.
Mm-hmm.
Again, one of the Germans that came over with foreign paper cluster.
Okay. Because I found that in doing my research, I really don't have much pre-60 information, 1960 information, from the Rocketdyne side of things. It's like they were doing component testing out at Edwards, and things didn't really take off on the F1 program until NASA and then Marshall acquired the program,
okay.
And of course, I guess 61. Yeah.
To test the engines out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to have quite a good production run of engines. We concluded we needed 3 single position production test stands, which were built at Edwards.
Yes.
In addition to the R&D stands we were.
There were component stands there, I guess, one for thrust chamber.
The component stand, the only component stand we had at Edwards was a thrust chamber stand.
Yes, uh-huh.
The turbo machinery stands were another part. But
oh.
They didn't generate an awful lot of noise.
Okay.
And you know, the thing about the F1 is when you were firing a thrust chamber, it generated a tremendous amount of noise. I thought it was well.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
It wasn't practical to put one in at Canova Park, firing in the direction of Santa Cruz.
Wouldn't
Park.
Want to do that.
Hoka Park, you'd have a lot of...
Well, when they had their small, the A1 test stand, they had small test stands initially.
Exactly.
Testing the Navajo engines and so
exactly.
forth, that was fine. But with the... they even tested H1s in, I think, in Canoga. But nothing bigger than that.
That's right. We did our S3D testing there. We did our H1 testing there.
Yeah. Okay, let me...
And with all the whistles and bells on it, and a lot of people just can't afford that.
Yeah, that's right.
So apparently they're coming out with several tiers of Corvette for the next generation car in 96 or 7 or something. But what I'd like to do is, I brought my camera up. I want to take a couple shots of you, photographs.
Okay.
And because I'm trying to get as many photographs into the book as I can. We're going to have like 200 black and white photos, 50 color photos.
Mm-hmm.
Let me do that. Let me do the leave my card too.
All right.
And if we can't, maybe we can go outside here.
Sure.
Because it's a little dark in here.